first date in their calendar is 97, 11, 11, State, Ohio, versus Shannon Sturgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve any time that I have remaining from my argument for rebuttal. While here on the issue of capital punishment was inadequate in this case, because the trial court failed to disqualify all of the prospective jurors. This creates an unacceptable risk that an automatic death penalty or AVT juror status penalty may. We present this issue in our first proposition of law. In John Stojek's case, the trial court disqualified all of the prospective jurors. The trial court asked all of the prospective jurors if their views on capital punishment would prevent or substantially impair their ability to consider the death penalty. However, the trial court did not, sua sponte, life qualify all of the jurors, or did death qualify all of the jurors. The trial court did not, sua sponte, life qualify one third of the denier and one half of the actual sentencing jury. I think Your Honor is an extension of Morgan based on principles of Morgan, but I think there is definitely authority under Ohio law for this minor extension of Morgan to a sponte life qualifying jury. I say that based on a State v. Johnson quoting Powell v. Alabama, in which this court stated that the trial court has a duty to protect the rights of the accused and to ensure that full justice is accorded to the accused. And that duty, the court said in Johnson, is part of the duty the trial counsel has. Now, certainly, the service of an AEP juror, Morgan instructs us, would be a violation of the defendant's right to due process because an AEP juror will not consider mitigation. Therefore, the trial court under Johnson has a duty to protect the defendant from the service of AEP jurors. Moreover, Your Honor, I think there is authority for this minor extension of Morgan to a sponte under state law that we find under the revised code. I believe that the trial court has an affirmative duty under the revised code to a panel of fair and impartial jury. Revised Code 294527 states that the trial court shall examine the jurors as to their qualifications to serve. Now, the term qualifications to serve as a fair and impartial juror has a special meaning in a capital case. A juror is not qualified to serve in a capital case unless he or she can fairly consider not only the death penalty but also a life sentence. So I think that based on State v. Johnson and also the duty to examine the jurors under qualifications under the revised code, there is authority for the rule that we are proposing of to respond a life qualifying the jury, even though admittedly, Your Honor, there is a distinction between Morgan, because Morgan was based on the trial court in that case precluding the question being asked, and here the defense counsel didn't ask it for
it. Mr. Wilhelm, in the maybe the bigger hurdle is that this would have to be, this error is a plain error, if any, because there was no objection.
Your Honor, I think that it would be unfair to apply the waiver rule to this issue because the State of Ohio, sua sponte, obtained death qualification of every single juror. I think it would be arbitrary to therefore require the defense counsel to request life qualification to ensure a fair and impartial jury on the issue of the ultimate issue of punishment when the state obtained questions from the trial court without any request.
But those questions are more established. It's pretty well settled that you death qualify a jury, isn't it? I mean, in this case, the defendant's asking the court to take a step that is not already established in the law, and yet he makes no objection.
I would disagree, Your Honor, that it's not established, because as I said, the revised code puts a duty on the trial court to examine as to qualifications. Right. So then we have to ask ourselves, what does that term qualify to serve mean? In a capital case, I believe it means that the juror must not only consider the death penalty, but also a life sentence. certainly in any other criminal case, we couldn't have a juror who would only consider guilty verdicts but not guilty verdicts.
Mm-hmm.
And the death penalty is very much like an acquittal of, a life sentence is very much like an acquittal of the death penalty. So we have to have jurors who will consider both sides.
If we do not, the proposition that this is not waivable, that's really what you're saying. So
yeah,
we can't apply a plain error standard because it's not waivable.
It would be arbitrary, Your Honor, to apply waiver to this issue because, as I said, the standard to take the death qualification.
I understand. Can you give us an example of another scenario where we would determine that it's something is not waivable? What other not waivable by virtue of it being arbitrary? Normally we look for an objection. If it's not objected to, it's waived, and then we look at it under plain error.
Yes, sir.
So you want an exception to that?
The typical scenario is, of course, that perhaps where would a waiver rule apply before evidence is admitted,
mm-hmm.
and defense counsel is silent. But the evidence is, although arguably prejudicial, is nevertheless ruled as admissible. So there's a question under the typical error type of case where you apply by error, whether an error actually occurred. I think that there's a distinction here because we're talking about a duty put on the trial court that it has to determine. The ultimate responsibility rests with the trial court to entail a fair and impartial jury. And in this case, Your Honor, the trial court on page 192 of the transcript stated that. The trial judge recognized that ultimately it's my responsibility to ensure that the jury doesn't see the fair and impartial. And because of that duty, that's another reason why this issue should not be deemed waived. Because there is the ultimate responsibility on the trial court to entail a fair and impartial jury. So even if Your Honor doesn't accept my proposition that it would be arbitrary and unequal, I still think the issue can't be waived because the duty of the trial court to see a fair and impartial jury is not as narrow as it should be subject to plain error.
But isn't it also the duty of the defense counsel and prosecution both to determine that the court does do that? I mean, you just can't sit there and see the court doing something that you feel or you know it should do without saying, you know, either a sidebar conference or some type of indication to the court and look, judge, I think that you have to do this or do that. You just can't sit there and not inform the trial court that he might have missed something or that he should have done something and rely on him doing it sometime in the future. Don't you have that obligation to bring these things to the trial court's attention when they seemingly are making a mistake?
I agree, Your Honor, and that's why we've also raised this claim as a claim of ineffective counsel for not invoking the protections of the order.
So you want it on waiver, mm-hmm. on non-waiver, and on ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes.
At one hand, you're arguing you don't have to raise it because it's fundamental and unfair not to do it. I thought you said that you didn't have to raise it and that because counsel didn't raise it, that doesn't make any difference. It's still an error. Aren't you saying that? Now you're saying that the counsel was wrong when he didn't raise it.
Well, I don't think it would be a reasonable strategic decision for counsel to forego a life qualification. However, I don't think that we should reach that IAC claim because I believe that it is not an error that should be subject to the waiver doctrine because, once again, this is the essence of the equal protection claim that we've raised. It's fundamentally unfair to say that we're only going to examine jurors on their views regarding the death penalty, and we'll do that to a sponte, but if for in order for the trial court to examine the jurors' views, whether they can consider a life sentence, you have to request that. It seems to be extremely disparate and arbitrary to require defense counsel to ask for a fair and impartial jury when the state gets that to its pocket. And that's the essence of why I believe the waiver should not apply to this claim.
So you've used the term sua sponte. There's no requirement that jurors be death qualified, is there? The statute doesn't require that question to be asked, does it?
Your Honor, I believe think it does under Revised Code 2945-25C, which there is a directive to determine that the jurors may consider the death penalty under that as a statutory directive.
Following up on what the Chief Justice has just asked and your earlier argument, let's accept your argument of non-waiver, life qualification. Let's focus in then for a moment on the two jurors. What is your complaint about the two jurors? It seemed to me that if I had been the prosecution, at least one of them I would have tried to remove from the jury. The one who said, as I recall, I'm Roman Catholic and I forgot to be against the death penalty, but I know there should be punishment, and finally said, I guess I could probably do the right thing if I'm called upon to do it.
Yes, sir, that's Juror Hurst. But I would concede you that it is very unlikely that Juror Hurst was an automatic death penalty juror.
Okay, how about Coffin? Coffin? Coffin was the same sort of situation.
No, Your Honor, I believe there definitely is a substantial risk that Coffin may have been an automatic death penalty juror. And the failure to voir dire on that life qualification issue with Coffin is the error in this case. If the court looks at pages 61 through 63 of the transcript, we see that there was no question asked of Coffin by either the trial court or defense counsel if Coffin would consider a life sentence upon a guilty verdict.
Yeah, I can see that, but what Coffin did say when asked was something to the effect that I'd find it very difficult to ever give the death penalty. It wouldn't be easy. I hope that would never be called upon to make that decision. Is that what Juror Coffin said?
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't believe that does not show that she was not an ADP juror. It's true that Coffin said that she did not wish for the death penalty. However, an automatic death penalty juror does not necessarily have to be a strong proponent of capital punishment and life capital punishment. It is just as reasonable to think that an ADP juror may dislike the idea of capital punishment, but nevertheless thinks that if the state is going to have the death penalty, then the automatic use of it is the fairest and least arbitrary way to apply it. So simply because the juror does not like the death penalty in the abstract does not mean that the juror will not be able to apply the death penalty automatically, or even if that's the fairest way to have the death penalty.
Do you believe that Morgan versus Illinois is your best case? Because Morgan versus Illinois, to me, when I went back and looked at it, is clearly distinguishable. Because in Morgan versus Illinois, it seemed to me they were saying about death qualification that it couldn't be automatic votes for that. Now, how do you apply Morgan to your waiver argument and to your life qualification question?
In essence, what Morgan says, it explains first in the opinion that death qualification is required because the state is entitled to a fair jury. From that, Morgan says, relying on officers of Oklahoma, that's the transition case to get to the holding of Morgan, that life qualification is also required upon request of defense counsel, because likewise, the defendant, the capital defendant, is also entitled to a fair and partial jury. That is a jury that will consider life, even if the defendant is found guilty of capital murder. So, Your Honor, what in essence is the distinction here is simply that in Morgan, the Supreme Court was faced with a narrow issue where there was the trial court denied a request by defense counsel. And here, of course, we don't have a request by defense counsel.
No, I thought Morgan said that counsel had to request a life qualification. Okay.
Morgan, that's the distinction between our situation and Morgan is that the discrete issue presented in Morgan was based on defense counsel made a request and it's denied. And what I'm arguing to the court is that we should extend Morgan as a matter of state law to require life qualification to respond to, and I believe there is authority for that, as I answered the Justice Francis question earlier, is that the court has already recognized in Johnson, quoting Calvin of Alabama, that the trial court has a duty to protect the rights of the accused. And one of the rights of the accused is to have a jury free from the service of ADP jurors. If an ADP juror serves, a single ADP juror serves, that violates the defendant's due process right to a fair testing jury. the most logical, simplest, easiest way to guard against that unacceptable risk is to simply have the trial court, when it does qualify the jury, ask the flip side of the question. It's one simple question. We're not asking for any undue burden or limitations on the discretion of the trial court.
How would you phrase that?
The trial court would ask the question, would the prospective jurors' views on capital punishment substantially prevent or impair the juror's ability to consider a life sentence that the defense is self-guilty of capital murder?
Okay, now whenever you get to the charge in these cases, you in effect give the life sentence charge anyway, don't you?
It's too late, then, Your Honor, because if an ADC juror has passed muster of what here they become the jury, they can't follow the law and apply the charge to the law. And that's what the court recognized in court. There is a substantial risk because of the service of juror Coffin that an ADC juror sat on John Fisher's panel. The problem with that, Your Honor, is the trial court instructed on principal offender, prior calculation time, and aider of that. But did not instruct the jury to come to a unanimous finding on an alternative theory. And we submitted additional authority that's released from this court very recently, State versus Moore, which, although not directly on point, said that there should be a unanimous finding on alternative theories. Of course, in Moore, the difference was that we were dealing with the different components of the need set of specifications. Prior counsel signed with the principle, but I think that logic would also apply to the trial at his charge.
But if there was a finding that committed the murder in prison, the subject would be definitely, how does that matter?
The prejudice was because the instruction on the alternative theory came on aggravated murder itself. Not the specification of the actual finding of aggravated murder under 2903.01a. So the jury was told that it could find Sojet guilty as either the principal or as an aider or abettor of aggravated murder, but there was no jury form that required specific unanimous finding on one or the other alternative theory. And we submit that in approach as a war, as the court said that there should be a specific finding. What here in this case was inadequate, there's an unacceptable risk that an ADP juror sat on the panel with Juror Coffin. The supplemental voir dire of defense counsel should not give this court confidence that Coffin was not an ADP juror.
Counsel, this event occurred after the effective day of life imprisonment, possibility of parole being included in the statute.
The offense was April 19th,
and so the life without possibility of parole was a possibility.
If the offense occurred after the effective date of statute, that's correct.
Yeah. What was the offense?
Well, life without parole. I have to check our jobs with you. I have to sit there.
Would that make some
difference in terms of your argument with respect to the life qualified jurors?
I don't think it would, Your Honor, because either way, life with a possibility of parole after 20 or 30 is still a sentence. And that is a license the jury has to be able to consider. I mean, the distinction is that sort of death sentence and life sentence are two sides of the capital sentence of the coin, the jury has to consider both. So even if there's a third option under the life sentence, the issue is can the jurors consider life as an option, regardless of whether it's without parole or 20-30. So I don't think it's a mitigation. An ADP juror will not consider mitigation. and mitigation was very crucial to John Stokes, as we've argued in our second proposition of law. Stokes had very compelling mitigation. This is a unique case in which there was a causal nexus between Stokes' personality disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and provocation by the victim and the circumstances of the offense. So there's mitigation here under B1, B2, B7, and the nature of circumstances of the offense. Dr. Iver, the psychologist for the defense, testified at the penalty phase that Stokes scored very high on the PTSD scale. It was very pronounced in Stokes. The effect of PTSD is, according to Iver, it makes Stokes like a survivor of combat. He was hypervigilant, he was always on guard, he was constantly afraid for his safety. That's significant because we have provocation by the victim in this case. The victim, Danico Watkins. Watkins was a 17-year-old juvenile who was tried and incarcerated as an adult. There's an indication on the record that he was a member of a gang. It was a very dangerous and rowdy gang. And there's testimony on the record that even the corrections officers were weary of this gang and had invaded him at Madison. Watkins beat up a frail juvenile friend of Stokes named Doug Haggerty. During the course of one of Watkins' friends stealing from Haggerty, after Watkins beat up Haggerty, Watkins then, anticipating retaliation from Stokes without any proof, said that he was going to get Stokes and take Stokes out and all of the area brotherhood because of what the assault on Haggerty. This threat was relayed to John Stokes. As a result of Stokes' PTSD, his constant hypervigilance, he perceived that threat much differently than anyone in a normal situation would. He was constantly afraid for his safety in terms of threats that were expressed to him, and threats were very real to John Stokes because when he was incarcerated in Lutherville, he had his throat slit from year to year. Dr. Iver testified that he saw the scars. This offense resulted because of provocation by Danico Watkins, not against beating up Haggerty, but in threatening to get Stokes after he beat up Haggerty. The issue of capital punishment involves the moral culpability of the defendant, not the legal culpability of the defendant. Certainly, Danico Watkins' death is tragic, and legally, Danico Watkins is a victim. But morally, Watkins is not a victim. Morally, Watkins provoked Stokes. Morally, the moral culpability of Watkins.
Isn't that a possibly weak argument? Your first argument was a
blatant. No, it's not, Your Honor, because we have plenty that says there's some sort of.
She says it's looked at threat about somebody who's sitting in the area of the nation. The allegation that your client was the head of an organization that
caused his own property. What's mitigating here is the fact that Watkins actually threatened Stokes' life. And as a result of PTSD, Stokes perceives that in a very different manner than a normal person would perceive a threat. He's hyper-vigilant, on guard. Watkins, by being involved in beating up other people,
let me drag you back to your first episode.
That's mitigation. That's mitigation by the statute. That's what's prevailed.
Does that have any implications on the previously decided
proposing that this rule applies to this case and future cases. That it would be retroactively applied to trial that happened before the case. And the court could write the case and say that.
While we have you off of that, you were interrupted with the plea you were making. I'd like to just go to another extraneous matter that is concerning me in the case that is very little and not hammered on much, but concerns me. Is it true there was no separation of witnesses here?
Yes, It's not on the record, Your Honor. There's no indication on the record that there was a separation of motives. And usually that appears on the record, so it's inevitable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you always ask for that, and the judge always grants it. Now,
yes, and there's nothing on the record to show you. Yes, that's correct. I mean, whether or not it sat in court, I can't tell you from the full record.
No,
I only know that what's not on the record, and there's no separation of what's on the record.
Don't you think that the defense attorney would have been aware of that and said, Your Honor, some of the sitting in the back court, people would have testified that. Would they have asked for it?
Well, yes, they should have asked for it. They should have asked for it on the record, but it's not on the record.
You have no proof in the record that there wasn't separation.
You never
that's
do.
Correct, right? As I said, I
you
can't
never do.
Full record,
those in the record
or the unreported by far, it's
in
the
record
that
it
was not certainly, there is provocation by the victim in this case, Anita Watkins. He threatened John Sogas, and John Sogas, as a result of PTSD, reacted to that. The moral culpability of Anita Watkins through his threat reduces the moral culpability of John Sogas.
Counsel, what is the purpose of the moral culpability? What you guys have hearing for what their purpose is?
It's not on the record, Your Honor. I can surmise that for John Soja, probably the purpose was to have safety in prison by being in a gang, because that's one way that people get safety in prison is to be in a gang. John Soja has been assaulted in prison several times and felt the need to be safe in prison. And we also need to take into account the fact that Nico Watkins was a gang member himself. And certainly we have provocation by the victim in this case, and there's a causal nexus, unlike other cases, between the personality disorder and provocation by the victim. This court should vacate on the first proposition of law and remand the case for a due penalty phase of revised code 2929-6. On the second proposition of law, this court finds no error. The court should vacate the death sentence pursuant to its independent review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilhelm. Mr. Cronin.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Please support counsel. Anita Watkins and his death did not provoke John Sogas who did nothing to bring the case upon him. The night before, there had been a fight involving Mr. Cassidy, and there were rumors or innuendos that Watkins was involved, but in fact, he was not involved. All the principal defendants involved in that argument, Dave Cassidy and another young black man, were sent to the hole at mass discretion. Watkins was in his cell at the time this occurred, and at the time so it had been his friend and her dad's name.
Before you get too deeply into that, did you try this case?
Yes, sir.
Was there ever a motion for separation of witnesses?
No, Your Honor. There was not.
Because that would be in the record if it had happened. And so there was no separation of witnesses.
There was no separation of witnesses. However, there were no witnesses in the courtroom except Sergeant Downey, who was the chief investigator for the Highway Patrol.
Who had to identify the shank, the knife. Exhibit 3. Oh, that's right. The other officer did.
There were Officer Browning, the officer who was in the union, identified the knife, and that's one issue that I would like to talk about concerning my alleged misconduct, pointing out that they just resume him. If you read the transcript, I'm discussing with Trooper for Officer Browning, you see who came in. He can identify, he says, so that that long dark hand of mine, very long knife. I have it come to the table, show him all the knives, and I ask him, can you point out the knife that Sogas attacked? And then my next question is, Station Exhibit 3, was not reflected in the transcript is that Officer Browning pointed at Exhibit 3. And I asked him, Exhibit 3, instead of saying, you have pointed out Exhibit 3. The key to remember is that three other witnesses after Officer Browning were able to put that knife into those hands. Andre Wright, one of the inmates that was present and viewed almost the entire incident as occurred in Holden, in the NSA unit. Officer Fullrod, who was one of the first officers on the scene, who was able to observe all six of the defendants, and especially Mr. Sojas as he was walking around or chasing the inmate through the pod. And finally, Officer Wolverton, who was one of the two officers that had just tried to go into the building as it was heard and was caught by Sojas with the scene.
Were any of these people you've just identified in the courtroom during any portion of the testimony?
No, Your Honor.
Just the one officer.
Just Officer Downing.
Would you identify Downing as a key witness?
Not really, Your Honor. He was more of a, for lack of a better word, our air boy for getting all the information for us, running messages and so forth. And that was primarily why he was important. As far as his testifying to any of the incidents that occurred, he testified to nothing would happen. He was more of a chain of custody witness. He was the one who was running evidence back and forth from the DCI patrol. He had to go to get blood samples from the defendant, situations like that.
Mm-hmm.
He had actually no involvement with the initial investigation besides controlling who was coming and going. At the time this occurred, Lieutenant Mike Schrock was the chief investigating officer in charge of that scene until about 3 weeks after this incident occurred and then he became
okay.
The officer down.
What do you think about the life question that counsel presents to us?
Your Honor, if you review the transcript, defense counsel John Dowdy had the opportunity to ask that question and in certain circumstances did in fact life qualify to the jury. Judge Nichols gave the defense counsel as well as the prosecution wide latitude to ask whatever he wanted to of every juror. And in certain circumstances,
pretty unsympathetic one in the eyes of
expect to already in prison.
Correct.
Head of the area of the
correct.
Circumstances surrounding the incident. He had a fell apart right at Watson's cell door. He had the opportunity to see the six men as they came in and chase him around to the pond for 10 minutes, stabbing him 40 times. Obviously gave him the impression that they were in fact there to kill him. And finally, he had the opportunity in the last 2 or 3 minutes of this young man's life to talk to Watkins. Watkins was up in front of his cell door, and Andre Wright, for his testimony, was telling him, jump over the railing, they opened that back door, there's Parrish and Wolverton, the two officers who came in, they got the door open, they were running for him. So he was able to testify beyond his opinion. He obviously was able to testify from his knowledge that, in fact, the defendant was stabbed by his men in his cell, and that they did come to the defendant to kill him. Also, there is an issue concerning the videotape being played. This videotape is in two parts. The first part was done as the events were occurring. They show the inmates, several inmates walking around inside with chains in their hands. You get a flavor of yelling and screaming that's going on. And eventually, after the inmates surrender, officer goes inside, goes upstairs, videotapes administrations of the nursing crew on the Maple Watch, and ends with that portion ends with Washington Court landing in a pool of blood, dead. Then switches to later that afternoon, we have a patrol officer retrace the blood trail throughout the Abbey unit. There's an objection that the jury was able to view the tape a second time. What may not be reflected in completely in the record is that prosecutors and defense counsel sat down and edited the tape. The sound was removed when the jury heard it a second time. There was no dwelling on the dead body of Demetra White. That it was a 2 second shock and then it was shut off. And of course, the blood trail, everybody was gone by that time, and it was just simply walking blood spots throughout the floor. We would admit that there was no prejudicial error in allowing the jury to view the tape a second time. In fact, that was the first thing they requested when they went into deliberation. About 15 minutes later, they requested the tape.
Mr. Wilhelm, you say 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Joe. Life qualifying a jury is not a radical proposal. It's a very basic, fair measure. It doesn't in any significant way hinder the trial court's discretion. It should make one year more efficient and concise for the trial court's review. It should also facilitate this court's review of voir dire issues.
But your argument is a constitutional argument. Now, since the statute requires death qualification, jurors, General Assembly obviously has not expressly provided for life qualification, your strongest argument has to be a constitutional argument, doesn't it?
I think there's an argument of due process of the protection you mentioned, Your Honor. But I also, as I said previously, there is a controversial statutory directive, I believe, that requires life qualification if we interpret the Life Code 2945.7, because it states the trial for challenging the jurors as for qualification. That's where the constitutional element of it comes in. What is the juror's qualification to serve in a capital case? Morgan instructs that the juror must be able to serve both life sentence and death sentence. So in order for a juror to have the requisite qualification to serve, as the statute directs, the trial court must examine and determine the ability to consider life sentence and death sentence. Certainly this is not a radical proposal. What we're simply asking for, to this court to level playing field. The juror who is going to make the ultimate decision of life or death can fairly consider both. And as Justice Piper stated to the counsel, opposing counsel, perhaps this is an unfavored defendant. Perhaps this is a defendant, certainly a defendant on the record where there is fairly substantial evidence of guilt. In such a case, the ability of a juror to consider mitigation is never more crucial. That's why life qualification for each prospective juror is essential. In this case, there is a substantial risk that one of the jurors who sat in the penalty phase, Juror Coffin, may have been an EDC juror. That is unacceptable in a capital case. Therefore, I urge the court to reverse this case, to adopt a rule requiring life qualification to responde, and to remand John Stoja back to the Court of Common Pleas, Madison County, for resetting before a new penalty phase jury under revised code 29.29.6.
Thanks, Mr. Wilhelm. The case is tonight submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.